This is the Medicast, April 23rd, 2007.
Transmitters? We don't need no stinking transmitters!
This is the Medicast, a podcast for EMS providers by EMS providers, featuring EMS news, products, tips, tricks, and commentary. So grab your gear and glove up. Here's today's show with the Podmedic, Jamie Davis.
Well, good day and welcome to the Medicast, episode 63. I'm Jamie Davis, the Podmedic, and I want to thank all of you for picking up the show, especially all of you brand new listeners. Stick around and check out the Medicast and see what it's all about. And of course, all of the long-term listeners, thanks for all of your comments, all of your emails, all of your everything you send into the show, all the things you do over at the website, the commentary on the different blog postings over there, all contribute to the Medicast community. And I really appreciate all of that effort that you put into helping me get this show out to the rest of you. I want to just mention real quickly here that the Medicast is a proud member of the Blueberry Podcast Network. Blueberry Podcast Network over at blubrry.com. A great place to check out a whole bunch of different podcasts of different varieties. Video podcasts over there as well as audio. All over at the Blueberry Podcast Network. And they do a great job of supporting my show and a bunch of other shows. And you can head over there and check out what they have to offer. Well, it's been a busy, busy weekend. It's really the first good weekend of spring, and it showed. We just ran our tails off today. We're a volunteer rural organization here, and I really thought I was going to be able to get the show in mid-afternoon. And when I start recording the show, I turn the pager off and dig in and get to recording. But I was over at the firehouse for some stuff this afternoon to drop some things off. And I got on one call, and it led to another call, and we just had wrecks, motorcycle accidents, people just not paying attention. They were so enjoying the view and the good weather, I guess they weren't watching the cars in front of them. We had a bunch of vehicles rear-ended, just people making mistakes and doing the things they do when the weather turns nice. So I hope the rest of you stayed safe this weekend, and I'm going to get on the show. We're starting recording a little later than I usually do. It's about a little after 11 here on the East Coast, and I'm going to stay awake and get the show done and get everything ready and out to you. Let's jump right on into some listener mail. I got a ton this week. The first email I have is from listener Asa, who comes from the Massachusetts area and is an EMTB. And Asa was asking about EMS scholarships and do I know of any that are available. And I really need to throw that question out to you, the listeners. And I think it's probably going to depend on what jurisdiction you're in. But I'm going to throw the question out there. What kind of EMS scholarships do you all know about? Let me know. Get back to me here at podmedic@mac.com or call the voicemail line. I'll have that later in the show. And check back with me and let me know what you know of that might be available, both nationally and in your local area or at the state level at least. I'm going to just throw out some general ideas. I've already emailed Asa back, and so I'll just go ahead and let the rest of you know what I think about this. First of all, I know that in Maryland, a lot of the training, at least to the EMTB level, is provided for free by the state of Maryland through the University of Maryland Fire Program. And that's one of the benefits that the state I'm in offers. I know that as I see articles coming up every week, there are scholarships for at least EMTB classes being offered in communities around the country as they struggle to fund and find people to volunteer in their local communities or to staff their local ambulance services, even if they're paid. So this is something you all need to kind of check into. Maybe it's worth it for you to move to a neighboring area and join a local company and sign some kind of an agreement. Some places are requiring you to maintain residency for a certain period of time, and you sign a promissory note that says you'll pay them back X amount of dollars if you leave before that time is up. And I think that's a reasonable expectation. They're expending the energy and the effort and the funds to train you. But I know there's other things out there, so you need to look around. I would check the EMS Today site EMS responder site and also at the GEMS site and see what they have to offer. And check with your local hospital services, your state level, your state volunteer fire association, and other organizations in your area and find out if they have any ideas. The other good thing to do is to check with your local community college and find out if they know of anything in their financial aid office. You might be able to find some great information from them. The next email I have comes in from longtime listener Chris, and Chris was letting me know about a call he had that involved a next due or mutual aid call for his company to respond into another state. And they don't usually go there, and it was a long transport time or travel time. They were going to be taking up to 40 minutes to get to this location. And I know Chris is in a pretty rural area, so I can understand exactly what he might be looking at, but this is for a diabetic patient. And, you know, it's easy for us to get in a rut, and this is what Chris kind of pointed out to me. He decided to try to dispatch a aero medical transport service to the scene to see, because he knew they could get there faster. And in fact, they did get there faster, cut his transport or travel time to the scene in half and got there in about 20 minutes. He continued in and was able to get there and transport the patient by ground. But it's important for us to remember, you know, we get kind of in a rut with dealing with certain types of calls, diabetic emergencies, especially at the ALS level. You know, so often we know what we're going to do when we get there. And often it's the same patient we deal with on a regular basis, right? So we get there, we pop an IV in their arm, we give them some D50, they wake up, they sign a refusal, and they go home. Sometimes there's something else going on and we can convince them to go to the hospital, but you know, this becomes pretty routine for us in our local calls response area. And this is why we need to really pay attention and remember that this is a true medical emergency. If we don't get there in time and their blood sugar remains low, they're going to suffer permanent brain injury. They're going to stop breathing. They're going to go into cardiac arrest, and we're going to get there and have to deal with a whole nother host of problems. So Chris, you know, I think you made the right call. I know you know that already, but it's important for us to really think about the type of call we're going, think about where we're going, and treat each call as an individual decision-making process and try to keep ourselves from getting blinders on and thinking that this is just going to be another of routine calls, because that's when you get yourself bitten in the behind. That's when you get caught unawares and bad things happen, either to you because you're not aware of scene safety problems in a location that you're used to going to, or the patient is not what you expected and you end up dealing with something that crept up on you. So thanks a lot, Chris, for bringing that to my attention and letting me share that with the listeners. I got another email from listener Josh. Josh just got his reciprocity approved for the state of Utah, and he's now approved as an EMTB there. So congratulations to you, Josh. Josh asked me a question about ammonia inhalants and do we use them on our ambulances and what I thought about ammonia inhalants in general. And Josh, you know, it's something I hadn't really thought a lot about. I know they exist out there. I see them when I go to places like, you know, where they take x-rays or lab work, and I see them taped up on the wall there, and I wonder how often they use them. But we don't carry them on our ambulances, so I decided to do some checking around, and I am going to talk about ammonia inhalants a little later in this podcast as this week's Med of the Week. So stay tuned for that, Josh, and everybody else, and I'll find some more information and get that out to you here a little bit later on. Finally, I got an email from listener Helen. Helen's a longtime listener who lives in the Southern California area, and she wanted to share some information with you all about a new podcast that she found over at the iTunes store. Helen found the University of Iowa Department of Emergency Medicine podcast, and there are quite a few lectures in there that she learned a great deal from. Helen, I want to thank you very much for that. You can either search for that over at the iTunes store, or you can get the link to it directly over in the show notes for this podcast. And Helen, thanks a lot. Hopefully, when I get out to the Podcast Expo in Ontario next September, we can catch up again with you and some other listeners and maybe talk a bit about EMS over a cup of coffee like we did the last time. So we'll catch up, and I'll let the rest of you guys in Southern California area know about that. It'll be the last weekend in September, and I will be heading out to Ontario, California for the Podcast Expo, so you all can catch up with me out there. I'll try to square away a morning where we can get together and talk a little bit about what we do and what you guys like about the show and podcasting in general. It'll be a good time to meet the listeners. I'm going to jump right on into the news so we can keep moving right along here this evening. The first story I found in the news has to do with a paramedic in the Houston area that was responding to a call and was struck by another driver at an intersection. The safety officer was heading down the state road and was colliding with a woman who failed to yield the right-of-way and hit the emergency vehicle. Now, the paramedic was not hurt, but the woman did suffer minor injuries and was taken to the hospital. You know, folks, we just got to be careful. I talked a little bit on my blog about taking patients to the hospital and their family members following us to the hospital, even though we were running lights. You know, it shouldn't be an issue with the patient's family member not heeding traffic signals. But, you know, we need to be careful when we get to these intersections because sometimes people are coming the other way and aren't paying any attention. We really need to be doubly careful. And we know what can happen when vehicles collide, so we need to be more careful about keeping on top of staying safe ourselves. I just have to keep talking about these issues. We need to remember to wear our seatbelts, both in the front and while we're in the back, whenever possible. There are steps being taken all the time to make ambulances safer, but the biggest thing we can do in the field is to make sure that we're secured when we're in the back of the ambulance and definitely when we're riding up front. This next story is causing me a bit of concern, and I'm going to get up on my soapbox, I think, a little bit here, but it's something I feel very strongly about. This comes out of the Mobile, Alabama Fire Rescue Department, where an employee who was in training there complained about use of racial slurs repeatedly during one of her paramedic training rotations. She eventually singled out exactly who was causing the issue, and the person that was causing the problem was fired. Now, they've since appealed that decision, and it's being reviewed, and blah, 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 blah. Here's where I come down on this issue. There's just no room for this kind of crap. I'm not going to mince words here at all. We have a job to do. We are a unique group of people. We are people that go out and help save lives all the time because it's something we feel called to do. And I don't care what color your skin is. I don't care where you come from. We all have that in common. And there's just no room for anything that we do that belittles anyone else because of anything about them, their color, their religion, their race, where they come from. You know, that's why I try to report on news stories from around the world and EMS, because you know what? We're all struggling with the same problems. Whether we're driving an ambulance for a civilian ambulance service in the middle of Baghdad, or you're driving that same ambulance in the middle of New York City, you're still dealing with horrible injuries, with people in need, and you're a unique type of person. EMS providers see things that no one else sees, not doctors in the hospitals, not nurses in the ERs. We see patients at their absolute worst. When we get them to the ER, they're cleaned up. I mean, they're looking better or at least have started treatment. They haven't seen them in the car mangled up, and we've got them out at least straightened out on the backboard before we get them to the hospital. So there's no room for this kind of garbage. And, you know, this is one of those things. You guys are the listeners to this show. I consider you the leaders of EMS. You're forward thinking. You're advanced in your decision making enough to want to be educated, to want to continue to learn and be at the front of your career field. And this is where you guys need to step up. You need to be the leaders now, whether you're in a management position or not. You're still going to be the type of person that needs to stand up and just say, you know what, this is unacceptable. You don't need to talk that way. And we need to get along with each other. And I know that's a cliche, and I know that's something that maybe we use too much, but if we can't get along in the type of work we do, in the type of camaraderie and brother and sisterhood that we have in fire and EMS services, well, where the heck are we going to start getting along with each other? I mean, I think if we can't get along in what we do, there's no point in even trying to get along anywhere. And I don't believe that. I think we can do this. I think we're better than this. And I'm calling on all of you, the Medicast listeners, to be the leaders that you are and just say no to this kind of garbage. And I hope that this is handled appropriately. I know personnel reviews and things like that have to be taken carefully and decisions need to be made. But I think we just need to take a stand and let our coworkers and the people that we associate with in this field know that this is just unacceptable to treat each other this way and treat anybody this way. All right, enough said. This next item in the news comes from emsresponder.com, and it's a commentary and a story related to the Virginia Tech shootings this week. And, you know, this is one of those things we just, whenever something like this comes up and we have mass casualty incidents, whether it's involving school buses or mass transit accidents on the roadways, or it involves something as horrific as somebody going on a shooting rampage and killing not just one or two people, but 20 or 30 people, it reminds us all that, you know, none of us can be considered completely safe. You know, this is a part of Virginia that's a pretty rural area. It's a little outside of the beaten path. It's not in that, definitely in the middle of that Washington, D.C., Northern Virginia metro area. And so this is something that could happen anywhere we are. This is just something we all need to be prepared for and pray it never happens. This is a nice article over there that has to do with dealing with patients in horrible situations like this. I'll read a little bit about the beginning of the article. Blood was pouring out of her body from 3 gunshot wounds, yet the female student was surprisingly calm and alert as paramedics worked to keep her alive. And this is just what we need to be focused on. This is why we don't have time for the stuff I talked about in the last article, because this is something we all need to be ready for. We need to avoid petty squabbles with neighboring jurisdictions, because when the time comes to call on them to help us, and it will come, folks, this stuff's happening more and more frequently. And if you think it's not going to happen to you, well, I'd read some of the comments of the student EMS providers who are members of the Virginia Tech EMS squad, or check with some of the many news articles dealing with the first responders on the scene and their reaction to the carnage that they found. This is something we all need to be ready for, to be thinking about in the back of our minds how we're going to deal with something like this if it happens in our community. Because I'll tell you what, the first couple of people on the scene are going to be the ones that make the difference for the severely injured patients that might survive, but won't survive if the right decisions aren't made immediately. I'm going to deal a little bit more with some of that, dealing with the National Registry test and another segment of how to pass the skills test coming up in the tip and trick of the week. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about that here. And I urge you to check out this and many other articles on this topic over at EMS Responder, over at GEMS, over at the major news sites. Search for the Virginia Tech story and find stories about the first responders. There's several of them. I reported on a different one in the Medicast News earlier this week. You can check that out at medicastnews.com, and there'll be some information in that link as well. You can also find a link to that over at the website at medicast.com. Finally, to continue on in the vein of trauma and casualties related to trauma, I found a report that was released that is from the World Health Organization, and it is stating that road traffic crashes are the leading cause of death among young people between the ages of 10 and 24 years of age. And this is in their new report on youth and road safety, saying that nearly 400,000 young people under the age of 25 are killed in traffic crashes worldwide every year. Millions more are injured or disabled. Now, some of the things they looked at was the fact that people from low and middle income countries and low and middle income people from any country, including the more advanced countries, are at greatest risk. Young males are at higher risk also than females. And this is something that we just need to keep in the back of our minds. This is one of those prevention is worth any amount of cure on the other end. And I think that's true here. We need to be advocates in our communities for wearing seatbelts. We need to be advocates in our communities for safe driving practices. And we need to be leaders in our communities to help young people understand road safety, how to cross the street, bicycle safety, all of the things that may come into play when dealing with motor vehicle collisions. So be aware of these things and check out this particular report. It's a good statement and some good statistics to use to maybe get some funding in your area to help do some teaching and education and community outreach. Well, the news is done, and it's time to move into some more of the continuing series here at the Medicast on the BLS National Registry Test for skills, and also the ALS National Registry Test. This particular item comes out of the BLS skills category, and it's one that we need to just all keep in the back of our mind. So whether you're testing soon or not, this is something that I think we all should pay attention to. First of all, if you're ever taking any of the skill stations, I will just go through some of my basic tips for taking the test. First of all, wear your gloves the whole day. Put them on in the morning when you get there, and don't you dare take them off until the very last skill station is completed. Why do I say that? Well, you don't have to worry about if you forget to say scene safety or BSI, because you'll be given usually the benefit of the doubt because you wore your gloves into the room. This is just a little safety practice. You still need to remember to say it, but sometimes this will get you off if the preceptor has decided that you were wearing your gloves, so you must have been thinking scene safety BSI. Again, maybe not all the time, but it's something that can save your butt. This is something I want you to do. If you're getting ready to take this test, I want you to sit quietly. I want you to listen to what I say and visualize yourself doing it. There's a lot of videos out there that show you different techniques and different ways to do it, but there's a lot of different equipment out there and different types of BLS bags. So this is what I want you to do. Visualize yourself doing this in your classroom setting where you're used to doing it with the equipment that you're used to using, and visualize yourself going through the process. Visualization is really important. It's useful. It doesn't take the place of actual hands-on practice, but if you've been doing a lot of hands-on practice, visualization can help reinforce that muscle memory and make it easier for you to do the things you need to remember to do when you get into your testing station with a whole lot less anxiety. You'll walk into the room and you'll be presented with a patient who has an upper or lower extremity injury. You'll initialize the situation after you've inspected your supplies by taking or verbalizing body substance isolation, saying scene safety, BSI. You're going to apply direct pressure to the wound with your gloved hand, or if you have it immediately available, quickly using a 4x4 and applying direct pressure to the wound. If the wound's bigger than that, you might need to use provided supplies such as an ABD pad or a larger trauma dressing. You will apply direct pressure and elevate the extremity. You will now be informed that the wound is continuing to bleed. You will apply an additional dressing on top of your original dressing and continue to apply direct pressure to the wound. You will now be informed that the wound is still bleeding and the second dressing is not controlling the bleeding. You will now locate and apply pressure to the appropriate arterial pressure point for that extremity. In the upper arm, it'll be the brachial artery, which is found just under the bicep. You will compress that area against the bone and attempt to provide pressure there and stop the bleeding. In the lower extremity, it will be the femoral artery found in the crease where the leg meets the groin. You will apply direct pressure there with the heel of your hand, and try to suppress the circulation from there to the lower leg. Once you've located and applied pressure to the appropriate point, you will be informed that the bleeding is now controlled. You will continue to bandage the wound, and you will now be informed that the patient is showing further signs and symptoms indicative of hypoperfusion or hypovolemia related to blood loss. You will position the patient properly. If appropriate, you will use Trendelenburg to elevate the lower extremities and continue to provide blood flow to the major organs. You will apply high concentration of oxygen via non-rebreather mask at 12 to 15 liters per minute. You will initiate steps to prevent heat loss from this patient, which means you'll either put a thermal blanket on them, a rescue blanket, one of those Mylar blankets, and other blankets as may be provided. Again, this is the reason you're checking your supplies when you get there. If you see it, you're likely to need it, and you want to put them in the order that you need to use them. And finally, you will indicate that a patient in this situation needs to have immediate transport to the hospital as a high-priority patient. Now, some critical criteria, things you need to pay attention to and make sure you do, because there are automatic fail points. First of all, scene safety, BSI. You do not apply high-flow oxygen when you notify that this patient is showing signs of blood loss and hypoperfusion. You apply a tourniquet before attempting to use other methods to stop bleeding. You do not control hemorrhage in a timely fashion, and you do not indicate the need for immediate transport. Any of these can be critical fail points in this particular scenario. Either way, you want to just listen to this section over and over again. But remember, this doesn't take the place for actual practice. Get out there with your friends. There's a link in the show notes to directly download the check sheet for this particular station, so you can use this in your class with your friends and work at this particular station. Practice bandaging different extremities, whether it's upper or lower extremities, and different pressure points. But once you're done practicing, you can use visualization techniques like this, just like athletes do, to make yourself a little bit more calm and reassured about what you're doing by reinforcing the muscle memory that your practicing has developed. And that's what visualization does. And it helps relax you, because you're going to see yourself succeed in the test, and you'll be able to pass the test and be a lot more calm when you actually walk into the testing center. I know you all can do it. So if you're testing for this, stay on top of it. And I hope this helps out. And that concludes this tip and trick of the week. With the tip and the trick of the week done, it's time to look at this week's Med of the Week. And as I said earlier when responding to some of the listener email, I'm going to be talking about ammonia inhalants. This is a topic that I hadn't really thought a whole lot about, but as it occurred to me, it's something that some of us may carry on our units. And in fact, I know some of my neighboring jurisdictions carry ammonia inhalants on their units. And I've seen it used in hospitals and available for use at x-ray centers and laboratories where blood's being drawn. And it occurred to me as I was thinking more about it that I didn't really know what the ammonia inhalants were made of and how they actually worked. The ammonia inhalants consist of a glass ampule containing a solution of ammonium hydroxide, denatured alcohol, ammonium carbonate, and water. This particular ampule or capsule is broken by snapping it between your fingers. It releases a solution of ammonia gas. The noxious scent of this particular gas has a stimulatory effect because of its high irritant factor on the respiratory system. You actually, if you are a conscious patient or just slightly unconscious, I guess, not completely unresponsive, like a patient who's drunk or under the influence of something, you are going to cause a violent reaction as they withdraw from this irritant. And as I looked into what actually went into the production of this material, it occurred to me rather quickly that I don't think it's a good idea that we be waving hazardous materials or chemicals under the noses of our patients. And I think that I found several articles over at GEMS by physicians, one of them most notably by physician Brian Bledsoe, who is also a paramedic, and they talk a little bit about this. So there's links to both of those articles at the website. But I'm going to talk a little bit more in depth of specifically why we don't want to be using this particular chemical or medical treatment and what we might use in its place. First of all, ammonia inhalants are not going to wake up a patient who is truly unresponsive. So if you have a patient that's actually really unconscious, not just lethargic or slightly out of it, they are not going to wake up from ammonia inhalants. This is usually used for people who have had a fainting spell or are under the influence of some kind of drug or alcohol and you want to wake them up. My first question to you is, why do you want to wake them up? I mean, really? You know, we know about what's going on with them, or we suspect. Do we really want an awake drunk or an awake drug abuser in our ambulance? We can manage them and do things a little bit differently. We have things like finding out if they're alert to painful response, if they're not alert and oriented, or not alert to a verbal question. If they are alert to a painful response, you can use a sternal rub. You can use a painful stimulus to the hand, wrist, or ankles, or feet. There's many different things you can do that will not cause any kind of respiratory problem or permanent harm, which may occur from waving ammonia inhalants under somebody's nose. The problem is that if you try to do this to somebody who's truly unconscious and they continue to breathe in the ammonia inhalant without the reaction of trying to get away from it, you can actually cause airway inflammation and irritation that could ultimately cause them to asphyxiate. So we don't want to wake up people that wouldn't be necessarily helped by the ammonia inhalant. So what else do we need to know about this particular thing? Well, some of the other problems that we note with ammonia inhalants is that patients with altered mental status or altered level of consciousness, this is not going to change the way we treat them. We're still going to apply oxygen. We're still going to do all the things we do. So the ammonia inhalant is not really all that necessary. And there are additional hazards that can be found in using the ammonia inhalant in this situation. It is a direct respiratory irritant. Patients with respiratory problems, with asthma, people that respond adversely to any kind of sudden respiratory stimulus, you can trigger asthma attacks. You could trigger a bronchial inflammation with this particular irritant. All of these things can cause your patient to become worse and cause a situation that was already in a priority two or maybe close to a priority one situation to a definite priority one situation. Also, ammonia is a direct skin irritant, is a direct eye irritant. And so anytime you're putting this stuff and waving it underneath their nose or holding it near their face, you're causing the possibility of trauma to their eyes, inflammation to their nasal passages, or actually direct skin irritation to the mucosa or the external epidermis. All of this is possible if you're not careful. So why are we going to do this? The other question is, if you have a patient who's unconscious, what if they have concurrent trauma that you're not aware of, causing them, if they are going to have a response to this particular technique or treatment, is going to cause them to have a sudden reaction that may cause paralysis or worsen an injury that is already present. And to what avail? Again, why are we using it? We have other methods to do. We have other ways to treat this. And I really think this is really an archaic treatment, something that's probably been around. If you're using it in your service, you're using it because, hey, we've always used it. Well, I'm here to tell you that that's not necessarily what we need to be doing. Think about what you're doing in the field. Think about your practices. And so my answer to all of you as the listeners as this particular Met of the Week comes to a close, is that I really think ammonia inhalants as an EMS field treatment for patients who are questionably unresponsive is not a good idea. You know, it comes down to this, folks. Just let sleeping drunks lie. There's links to the two articles in the show notes, so head on over to medicast.com and you can check out both the article by Dr. Bledsoe and the other net article that I found by Dr. Rodenberg, both of them talking about exactly why it's just not a good idea to be using ammonia inhalants in the field. And that, folks, is going to wrap up this week's episode of the Medicast. I want to thank all of you for checking out the show, for all of your comments. This is where you can find out exactly how to get in touch with me. You can reach me by email at podmedic@mac.com. You can also catch me at the Podmedic's voicemail line at 941-306-3342, 941-30-MEDIC. You can call in directly to the voicemail line and leave a message there, and I'll play your voicemail here on the air. Make sure you include at the very end your email address, so if I have any questions, I can get back to you. Don't worry, I'll trim it out before it gets on the show. Also, you can head on over to the website at www.medicast.com, and that is the official site and blog for the Medicast podcast. And make sure you head over there periodically during the week. I usually post about 4 or 5 other articles besides the show notes for this podcast that I find as they come up. Different ideas that occur to me, different articles, different research studies, things that I get from listeners that I think might be best shared with you during the course of the week. All of that can be found over there. And at the bottom of each entry, you can comment on that particular entry over at the Medicast, and you can see the comments from other listeners there as well. If you haven't posted a comment before, your first comment will be held up until I can approve it. Don't worry, I usually check in on each of those at least once a day. So as soon as I see that it's from you and not a spam item, I will approve it. And then subsequently, you'll be allowed to post comments as you'd like over at the Medicast to any of the articles and items over there. If you'd like to get a copy of the show notes emailed directly to you and other announcements as they become available here at the Medicast, you can sign up for the Medicast newsletter. There's a link in the show notes. There's a link at the top right-hand corner of the Medicast website page. You just fill out that little short web form, and you'll get an email sent to you to confirm. You'll need to click the link in the confirmation, and you'll start getting the Medicast newsletter directly sent to your email box. At the end of each show notes newsletter, I will include for you a separate little tip and trick of the week, just a little something extra for the Medicast newsletter subscribers, and you can get that for free. I don't spam you, I don't send anything else out to you, and I don't share that information with anyone else. This is just for me to keep better in contact with you over at the Medicast newsletter, so check that out. I will wrap up, as I always do, with some really great PodSafe music. This week, again, from the PodSafe Music Network over at music.podshow.com. This particular item is from an artist I've featured in the past. This is a new song from Bo Hall, and it's called She's Too Rich for Me, which I guess could refer to my lovely wife, Amy, who helps introduce the show at the beginning of every podcast and is hopefully soundly sleeping upstairs while I sit down here at 12:30 in the morning and wrap up the show. So while she's snoozing away, you can listen to Bo Hall's She's Too Rich for Me. Until next time, I'm Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic. Scene safety, BSI.
Here she comes. Soul. Well, she's looking and staring right through me.
the way she carries herself, I ain't got no chance. There I go, looking like a zombie. My eyes are blank and my mouth wide open and dry. If she only knew, I can make her happy. But she don't know my name, don't even know I'm alive. I think she's too rich for me.
Chance.